Movement La Via Campesina, and thanks so much to Lori Wallach of Public Citizen. We'll link to that report, NAFTA at 20, at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. If you'd like a copy, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berger, Nate Felsar, Mati Nirmanshake, Steve Martinez, Sim Akhof, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is WHFR Dearborn.
In 1972.
Well, we're starting New Year's off with a bang here at the new WHFR Journal. Welcome to our first alternative local news show of the year. And happy to be with you, that's for sure. Happy to be anywhere, some people always say. This is the new WHFR Journal for January 3rd, 2014. And here in the studio with me is our news team staff member, John Conroy. So happy 2014, John.
And happy new year to you and all our listeners as well.
Absolutely. Here we are again. This is our 29th year of broadcasting that we just began last month, in fact. And I always say we're going to keep doing it until we get it right. You know, and better and better, a little bit every day. Obviously, we're going to have some commentaries from Jim Hightower. You always, almost always, if I can't stop the computer in time, hear one of them getting started. He had Jim Hightower, our nationally known populist commentator. He has one commentary about it's a curse, it's a blessing, and a good food movement. Wow. And then another comment on him, a little bit more negative. So we're up and down with him. Global bankers. What about those global bankers? You know, most banks are global organizations, not just local here. Yeah. So we have a lot of great news stories for you and some interesting commentaries today for the first year of the first day of the new year. And so let's get to it. Let me just sort of run down the few stories from the local papers from last week. It is a time for them to recap the highlight stories of last year, and I say, bah humbug, good riddance. We did those. If you want to hear all about them, folks, you can start listening to the archived episodes of the WHFR Journal. Just go to whfr.fm. They're all there, 52 or more hours, depending on how many Fridays there were last year. And you can catch up that way, okay? I mean, you know, they're all there. Do you really want to listen to them all again? I don't. We're in the new year. Let's get past them. Let's get into that new City Hall, okay? And without having too much remodeling cost, let's see what our new elected officials are going to do now that they're sworn in as of January 2nd to their elected office. Let's get things going here, huh? All right. And a couple of these are entertainment notes. The Detroit Symphony Orchestra, that's right, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra will be performing at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center, the center, right here in Dearborn. Okay, a week from today, that's Friday, January 10th, at 10:45 a.m. Whoa, you get up that early? Okay, I have to be here at the station already at that time, so I won't make it. It does cost $25 a person, but it's the Detroit Symphony. They're doing some Beethoven concerto, okay, with a piano soloist, I believe, too. So full Detroit Symphony performing at the center. And you say, you know, if your excuses are why you don't see the symphony, number one, it's downtown. I don't like to go downtown. Or number two, it's at night. Okay, that's not the case. So Friday, January 10th, 2014. And you might say, well, you're doing a commercial. Yeah, but I believe they're a nonprofit organization, so it's not a commercial if they're a nonprofit. And it's right here in Dearborn at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center, week from today, so tell family and friends. Now, there's no senior discount. It is $10, however, for children. What a great experience for a young person, by the way, and also students under 18. They don't say children what age. I assume under 12, I don't know, something like that. And DearbornTheater.com, I think it is, if you wanted the website of, but you could just search for the Ford Center Dearborn or something like that. And probably information, too, on the Detroit Symphony. That's DSO.org, I know that one anyway. Okay, so that's a great event, and it's 10:45 a.m. next Friday. There's an op-ed here I might want to share with you shortly. Big Band Bop and Pop Concert, all great performing musical ensembles of one sort or another, from the big band to the jazz groups and the singing groups. Once a year, they perform at the Ford Center. And theirs is, plan ahead a little bit, Saturday, January 25th. Okay? And the story was in the Dearborn Press and Guide, December 29th, last week Sunday. However, didn't say what the cost is, but all the proceeds go to helping scholarship money for the music program, music-related programs here at Henry Ford Community College. So that's a great thing to support and a wonderful venue. The Big Band Bop and Pop Concert, HFCC Big Band Bop and Pop Concert, is scheduled for the center on Saturday, January 25th. Okay.
And what time is that, Jay?
8 p.m.
8 p.m.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. You have to be able to stay up after dark for that one. Yeah. But they have the lights on in the building.
Oh, that always helps.
Yeah. They have the lights on in the building, so don't get worried there. Okay, so let's go over to our first opinion. Oh, okay. Let me grab the paper it's in here. Is he reaching far? Yeah, you know it's the only news show where you can hear the pages turning on the air. I haven't used that joke for a long time, but it's true. It's true. But we don't usually rattle the papers on purpose like that. Okay, Chad Sawalski is one of their editorial commentators. He also writes a regular column for the Oakland Observer, it seems. And apparently he's liberal because they also found a fellow by the name of Mitch Kahishian, if I'm pronouncing it right, Mitch, who does an all-out Republican, conservative, Fox News editorial, also on the same page, I guess, for balance. But since we did a commentary last week about homelessness and, here, I decided that let's continue investigating this through Chad's comments. So take a listen. Here we go. The title, which was picked by the editor of the newspaper, "Will Income Inequality Emerge as the Top Issue in the 2014 and 2016 Campaigns?" And here's what Chad Sawalski says. "For many in influential political circles, the focus of the past week has been on the heartbreaking story of an 11-year-old girl named Dasani. Dasani is not a character in one of the many Christmas season movies. She is not the fan favorite in so-called reality TV show. She's just an American reality. In a five-part series, the New York Times documented Dasani's life as one of 22,000 homeless children in New York City. She lives in a ragtag shelter not far from the gleaming luxury apartment buildings of Manhattan. While liberals denounce the stunning income inequality documented by the Times, at least one prominent conservative, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich," he's on Fox News again. He's got some. Is he part of a group called The Five? Or anyway, he's one of a panel on a regular weekly show again.
He's got a new show. Yep.
Yeah. So he can't get rid of Newt. No. Anyway, Newt Gingrich declared that the gaping divide between the rich and the poor has reached obscene levels. That's what he says, even. And he asked, quote, "How can you justify the level of wealth in those big towers and the level of poverty in those alleys?" Chad goes on, "Something is happening out there in the political world. Macomb County is not Manhattan, but the rising number of homeless kids in Macomb schools caused some districts to establish school bus stops at cheap hotels where homeless families live on a long-term basis. In Macomb, a proud blue-collar ethnic county, we are witnessing a churning sea of change that has grown the number of working poor families. After substantial shrinkage in the manufacturing sector and rapid advances in technology, automation, and globalization, a staggering number of Macomb families now depend on some government help to survive from week to week. The annual Kids Count report for Michigan that was released last week found that the number of Macomb County children eligible for federal food assistance actually went up in 2012 to 1/4 of all kids, compared to the slightly lower rate during the depths of the Great Recession in 2009. So it's worse now, folks. In 1999, the last truly prosperous year in Michigan, get that? 1999 was the last truly prosperous year in Michigan. Just 4% of Macomb kids qualified for assistance. Since then, we have witnessed nearly a sevenfold increase, almost to 28%. The number of Macomb County K-12 students eligible for free or reduced-cost school lunches, meaning their parents are no more than 80% above the federal poverty level, has also increased, not fallen, since the dark days of 2009. Nearly half of our students, 59,000 kids, now qualify for a government-subsidized lunch. With 1 in 5 of children living below the poverty line, a big jump from 2009, is it a surprise that the proportion of Macomb's newborns and toddlers eligible for the Women, Infants, Children, that's WIC Nutrition Assistance Program, is at 40%? The picture is the same across much of Michigan, particularly in many northern counties. The bottom line is this: more than 1 in 3 Michigan children who come from a two-parent, two-child family are living in a household that earns less than $31,000 a year. And that's the official poverty level, I think, these days. That's what they call it. In America, we do not punish our children. We do not allow them to go hungry or live in squalor, regardless of their parents' flaws or failures. Or do we? He questions. More and more, we turn away from reality. Yet it appears that a grassroots mainstream movement to restore economic dignity for all is emerging in many sections of our nation. In the voter-rich upper Midwest, 2014 congressional candidates and 2015-16 presidential contenders who scoff at a substantially higher minimum wage, or who brush aside the need for long-term unemployment benefits, or, continued on page 12A, those who, support reductions in the food stamp program might find themselves precariously out of step. The nation is beginning, that's if the people vote who are homeless. I don't think you can vote if you're homeless. You don't have an address.
You don't have an address to use.
That's a little, as they used to call them, catch-22. Yeah. That the homeless would really like to get some help, and the politicians don't care about them because they can't vote if they're homeless.
Well, if you
they may care, but they don't really care to do something.
Well, your driver's license is your ID when you go to a voter's registration
place. Oh. Can you get a driver's license without an address?
All you need is a car.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
Maybe so.
But you have to be registered with the city, don't you, to vote in that city? How can they just show a driver's license if there's no address on it?
That would make sense.
We're going to look into that, okay. Yes. Yeah. When Dennis... Reimers gets back, our producer for the show. We're just treading water here until Dennis gets back.
We're not sure about that
one. That's right. We're gonna give him a big research task.
There we go.
He is coming back from Oklahoma, folks. Yeah. The last 3-4 days, he's been driving through you know what, the storm that we've had for the last couple days that hit Chicago and so on. So hope that he's well. And
I'm sure he'll be glad to take on that task.
I'm sure that's the least of what we're going to do for him. Chad Sawalski here continues to conclude, the nation is beginning to understand the recession never really ended. The damage it inflicted in lost jobs, lost homes, lost income has never been repaired. We still have too many workers chasing too few jobs. We have people working outside of their field for a fraction of the pay that they earned just a few years ago. We have countless families who have drained their retirement savings in futile attempt to avoid home foreclosure. Yeah, I'm going to just cut that short, see how it's going. My problem that he doesn't seem to address here, though, he says something's happening out there. Yeah, a lot of dissatisfaction, But in order to change things, I hate to be realistic here, a revolution really won't change it and won't happen anyway because of all the superiority of government military-type forces, including our police. So that's not the answer, you know. The only way to change things is to vote for the difference, and and that can be done. But and we'll look into this. But I don't think the homeless can vote. So that's an issue. That's Chad Sawelski writing his essay was reprinted in the Dearborn Press and Guide from last Sunday. So, what happened on the same day in history, you ask?
That's a big question to
ask. Well, I subscribe to an email, email-updates.history.com. Okay, so they should know. I mean, they're the website, for gosh sakes, that's called history.com. So, I mean, they got to know about this day in history. And they have somewhat entertaining, although it's almost like spam most times, day in history. January 3rd, they think the biggest issue is in 1990, General Noriega surrenders to the United States after 10 days of holding up at the Vatican Embassy in Panama City. The CIA operative and drug king, yes, he was both,
yes,
and head of Panama, militaristic, so he surrendered. It was interesting he did that after four nights of U.S. siege of heavy metal music. That's what we did. We got our biggest PA systems and speakers, and we turned it on their troops and on the Vatican Embassy, heavy metal music as loud as possible to shake the walls for four nights. And I guess he didn't remember to pack a set of earplugs or something. He finally gave up, and their troops all surrendered. And that's the way to do it. Boy, that's better than an atomic bomb. You know, I remember that. But, you know, Panama remembers it as a time that they were finally liberated and could start a democracy. You know, they actually were able after that to elect people that they wanted into government. And they're doing very well down there today. And in fact, it is the number one retirement haven for Americans in the world. I think technically more retired Americans have moved to Mexico just in terms of numbers over the years. But right now, today, Panama offers, okay, you have to learn Spanish a little bit, but they have wonderful health care, even if you had to pay it cash, per treatment, and internet, and all kinds. You say, well, it's too hot in Panama City. They got mountains. They got they got a volcano, too, that's dormant, thank goodness, at 12,000 feet. But they've got a city called Bouquet, which is in the western portion. I didn't know there was a western portion of Panama. I just thought it was the canal, you know. But 3,000-foot elevation.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like cool springtime Michigan, springtime weather there all the time. I was going to mention it to Joanne Kurchinska, who comes up at 2 o'clock for her Highway 61 show. In February, they're having the Bouquet Jazz and Blues Festival right down there in Panama, see? So it's only the second or third year of it, but they're getting something started, you know. So, also, what happened in history? So I looked down the list, all these different categories here from history.com. In 1999, the Great Lakes region digs out from a record blizzard. Now, I was here in 1999. I don't think it hit Detroit as much, but Chicago had 15 inches of snow in 1999. And, of course, that was allowing for it being a new year 15 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but that was a record, 15 inches. And we think we got at least 11 or 12 inches here. I mean, the way I shoveled it in Dearborn, I know somebody said on the radio this morning that Wyandotte officially got 11 inches. And yeah. You and Gros Isle said...
We had 11 inches as well.
You can you can tell.
We can definitely add that much. Yep.
Yeah.
And it's spreading east.
Yeah, yeah. They're getting what we've already had. Thank goodness it doesn't look bad for us for at least 2 days anyway. So that's good. In general interest in 1521, and you all remember 1521.
What a year.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Martin Luther was excommunicated. Shame on you, Martin Luther, and all those protests. He put a list on a wall of complaints about the Catholic Church of the day, and And look, now he's got a church of his own.
And now he's doing well.
Well, he's not, but, you know. Also in 1924, on January 3rd, King Tut's sarcophagus was uncovered. And they were so surprised, because number one, it was cursed, but number two, not really, folks. It was intact. It was like the last major tomb that they found that was intact. And, of course, King Tut was one of the more significant and unique of all of the kings, but a lot of stuff for archaeologists to go crazy about. 1924 and January 3rd, 1959. Alaska admitted into the Union.
And I was alive for that.
That event. Was that our last fifth? Was that state number 50? I think it was. Hawaii was before Alaska, I think. I always get them confused.
The Commonwealth or Puerto Rico is not a state.
A candidate.
But it's a candidate.
Yeah, we actually are in charge of Puerto Rico, folks, and they could become a state, just like Washington, D.C. could become a state if we let them. But they got to do a better job, you know. That those people in Washington, D.C., they're mostly corrupt, right? That's what I've heard.
Well,
so until Washington, D.C. is not corrupt anymore, you know.
They've had a few years to manage this, though.
Yep. Now, let's see what else. Literary people out there. 1841, Herman Melville set sail for the South Seas. Okay. Now, he's a great American author, and I've taught him in my classes, too. If he hadn't set sail for the South Seas, John, he would never have had the information to write Moby Dick, one of the great, great American novels, which I taught for many years here at Henry Ford Community College in the English department in 1851, 10 years later. So get that experience of life, folks, whether it's the South Seas or somewhere else. Just do it. Learn. Study. Grow. Yep. Go ahead.
And certainly what a great movie with Gregory Peck.
Oh, I've seen all of them. What's his name from Star Trek Next Generation?
Patrick Stewart.
Yes, Patrick Stewart, of course. He did one, too, mm-hmm. Made for TV. But, you know, because I taught the book, it's not the book. I mean, they go for the action story. Let's go out and kill a whale, and then the whale turns around and kills all of them instead, except for one guy who lives to tell the story. Okay, Ishmael. But, you know, so they go for the action-adventure part of it, and that's unfortunate because, they really shouldn't. Okay. What button I'm pushing here. Okay. January 3rd, 1987. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inducts the first woman. John, this is, again, I always give him questions he isn't ready for.
I'll say Janis Joplin.
Nope, a female from Detroit.
Oh, we'll say Diana Ross.
Maybe, I bet she's in there by now. Aretha Franklin. Franklin was the first woman ever inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and it took until 1987 for that to happen. 1938, January 3rd, Franklin Roosevelt founds the organization, the March of Dimes.
Oh, very good.
And of course, because it was treating diseases that he suffered from himself as a child, polio, and I forget what else, but, March of Dimes, happy birthday, I guess. And then 1968, January 3rd, Eugene McCarthy announces his presidential candidate, Senator Eugene McCarthy from Wisconsin. I think.
Not certain. Nope.
Minnesota? Okay. Anyway, his presidential candidacy. He was the peace candidate. And I remember, because I was in college in 68, in early 68 at the time. Early 68, I was here at Henry Ford Community College, but I was part of his campaign and helped organize. Of course, it didn't get past the nominating convention. Also kind of lost some steam because Robert Kennedy jumped in because a lot of people felt, well, Eugene McCarthy can't win. You know, he's a poet as well as a senator. Nobody will vote for a poet. I think I would have in this case. And then Robert Kennedy started saying peace-type things, get out of Vietnam, That was the peace issue then. And then, of course, he got assassinated. So, yeah, we got stuck with...
Hubert Humphrey was...
Hubert Humphrey, who was anti-peace protesters, anti-college students, how dare you say we shouldn't be fighting and dying in Vietnam, although he was a great liberal from Wisconsin himself, populist and so on, but he sort of changed when he was under Lyndon Baines Johnson as a VP, and, of course, Richard Nixon won.
I believe Hubert Humphrey was from Minnesota because the
Minnesota, there you go,
Metrodome was named after him.
Yep. And Jesse Ventura, I think, was governor of Minnesota. See, the kind of people in Minnesota, they're great. I love them. Okay, we're going to now listen to that other populist. Got to find a connection here somewhere. Jim Hightower. And we'll do both of his commentaries. The first one, as I told you, would be. Let's go with the other order. Why? Because you start, bad news and then good news, right? So global bankers, what are they up to? And then a curse, a blessing, a good food movement? Jim Hightower, listen up.
Here's an odd headline. It's hard to summon sympathy for big banks. Well, yeah, and why would you try? This piece began with another odd sentence. It's no fun to be a banker these days. Really? I'd think that counting those multi-million-dollar annual paychecks would be jolly fun. But money doesn't buy love, and it seems that the global princes of high finance are glum because they're not even respected, much less loved. Well, of course not. They've been pigs. No offense to pigs, but bankers have gotten filthy rich through greed, plundering, and damn the public narcissism. So not only are they social pariahs, but even bank regulators around the world are no longer as deferential as they were before the 2008 financial crash. While meek regulators haven't exactly turned into tigers, at least they're slapping some of the banking syndicates that caused the crash with multi-billion-dollar fines, and they're even publicly scolding a few of the banksters. This has set off a pity party among Wall Streeters and other big bankers. At what point does this stop? Whined a Bank of America executive. Complaining about paying out $13 billion for some of his bank's crimes, a J.P. Morgan poobah said, "We should all be concerned that there doesn't seem to be a natural endpoint to how high fines can go." Note that he wasn't concerned about an endpoint to the crimes bankers are committing. Likewise, the top executive of Deutsche Bank was outraged that a German official has criticized bankers there for evading regulation. "It's irresponsible to comment in such a populist manner," cried the haughty banker. Again, no concern for the irresponsibility of bankers who keep evading regulations. This is Jim Hightower saying, what we have here is business as usual. For bankers, it's still all about themselves, money over ethics, and they wonder why they're not loved.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
In 1972, I was part of a nationwide campaign that came close to getting the U.S. Senate to reject Earl Butz, Richard Nixon's choice for Secretary of Agriculture. A coalition of grassroots farmers, consumers, and public interest organizations teamed up with progressive senators to undertake the almost impossible challenge of defeating the cabinet nominee. The 51-44 Senate vote was so close because we were able to expose Butz as Butt Ugly. We brought the abusive power of corporate agribusiness into the public consciousness for the first time. We had won a moral victory, but it turned out to be a curse and a blessing. First, the curse. Butz had risen to prominence in the world of agriculture by devoting himself to the corporate takeover of the global food economy. He openly promoted the preeminence of middlemen food manufacturers over family farmers. "Agriculture is no longer a way of life," he barked. "It's a business." He instructed farmers to get big or get out, and proceeded to shove tens of thousands of them out by promoting an export-based, corporate-run food economy. "Adapt," he warned, "or die." "The ruination of farms and rural communities," Butz added, "releases people to do something useful in our society." This is Jim Hightower saying, the curse of Butz, however, spun off a blessing. Small farmers and food artisans practically threw up at the resulting Twinkieization of America's food. They were sickened that nature's own contribution to human culture was being turned into another plasticized product of corporate profiteers. They threw themselves into creating and sustaining a viable alternative, linking locally with consumers, environmentalists, community activists, marketers, and others. The Good Food Rebellion has since sprouted, spread, and blossomed from coast to coast. To find farmers markets and other expressions of this movement right where you live, go to localharvest.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And that was Jim Hightower there, localharvest.org. Just want to mention, and who knows, there might be growing things indoors somewhere, that the third Sunday of this month, I don't have my calendar. Oh, yes, I do. I'll find out the third Sunday. That is the at the center. That is when, oh, it's the 15th. Okay. That is when from 11 to 4 for free, it's the Dearborn Market. It's the indoor Dearborn Market, 11 to 3. And they will have, I'm sure they'll have baked bread and things because you don't have to go outside to do that. And so do some shopping from local merchants. There's also going to be, I understand, some regional vendors selling products of different sorts. But that's free. It's the Dearborn Market at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center on the 3rd Sunday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. of each month until they start the outdoor thing. So probably at least through April. Circle that on your calendars. And John, you've got an announcement about this weekend. In fact, today through Sunday.
Yes. We at Henry Ford Community College is offering a chance to waive the application fee beginning today, January 3rd through January 5th. And it's going to be done as a promotion at the Fairlane Town Center. And it's already happened December 27th through the 29th and will continue January 3rd through the 5th. We are waiving the application fee for newly admitted students for 2014. With more than 100 programs at affordable prices, an education at HFCC is the perfect gift.
Yeah, they have a new slogan, I noticed in the paper, Reimagining Excellence.
Excellent slogan.
Well, I don't know how many ways you can rethink excellence. I mean, to me, it's always the same. But there's ways that you can reimagine yourself, you know, recreate yourself to be excellent in a variety of ways, maybe in the same direction you're going now, or maybe in a new direction. And then with all those different programs we have here, I think that's really what they're getting at, is that reimagining process in your own head that leads to your own growth and development. Because excellence is excellence, however you apply that term, you know, whatever you apply it to. But yeah, this is the last weekend. They did that last weekend. And so there is an admissions sign-up table somewhere in the center of Fairlane Town Center. It's sort of like Where's Waldo. If you can find the table, you'll save $30. In fact, that announcement is not really written for the radio. When they say they're going to waive the fee, some people may think they're using their hand and flapping it back and forth. No, that's W-A-I-V-E, and this means it's free. Okay, you don't have to pay it. Okay, forget about it. Okay, and that's not just good for the winter semester, which starts January 13th, that is a week from next Monday. Classes, really, you've got to be enrolled here. You've got to be ready to jump in. You can't enroll after classes start, okay? That's too late for the winter semester. You know, 16-week winter semester starting on the 13th. However, they will waive the fee. You don't have to pay it. If you also would rather be admitted for spring semester starting in May, which is an 8-week, or summer semester, which is an 8-week, or I think even for the fall semester of 2014. So high school students, if you haven't gotten admitted here yet, you know, you haven't applied for admission, because if you applied, you already paid it. Sorry. But if you said, well, just to keep my options open, I want to apply to several colleges, you know, as I graduate from high school. And I've been meaning to apply to Henry Ford Community College, too. I hear they're pretty good, you say. And you're saying it correctly, I believe. And remember, all the opinions expressed in this show are not necessarily those of Henry Ford Community College, except that one.
Except that particular.
That one is, yeah, they'll tell you that too. And I think it's true. Okay, Fairlane Town Center, if you want to be admitted here for any semester in 2014, you can do that in person. Take some identification with you, I bet. They want to see a couple of pieces of ID because you fill out the application there and you don't have to pay the normal $30. You'll get started in the process. So that's a great idea. And that's at Fairlane Town Center today through Sunday at an admissions table, HFCC admissions table somewhere in one of the main courtyard areas. Okay. Back to the new WHFR Journal, making waves here. Henry Ford Community College's own non-commercial independent radio station, staffed with more than 60 volunteers, such as John Conroy, who does not make a penny. But he gives us his time, and I can say thank you to you and to all of our staff who have been, all of our volunteers, unpaid volunteers, who have been keeping us on the air for the last couple weeks, you know, in all the storms and the blizzards. There was a couple moments we had a little transportation problem, but this station kept on going. Well, the college is out of session. They don't have any students broadcasting. Yeah, we do. We're 24/7 as best as we can manage, and it's the unpaid student volunteers who agree with our mission to give you radio programming, music, entertainment, and news like the Journal that you can't get anywhere else. Tell your friends. Tell your neighbors.
And we are the station that is, we are always making waves.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're waiving application fees and waiving in other ways, too.
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to then get into another opinion, because this is the time of opinions. Well, it's always a time for opinions, good opinions anyway. Michael Moore. You remember Michael Moore, a documentary filmmaker out of Flint, Michigan, now based in Traverse City, Michigan. And still a commentator on MSNBC and Fox News when they let him on. He had an opinion that was published in the New York Times editorial page at the end of last year. And I want to share that with you now. The Obamacare we deserve. Today marks the beginning of health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act's new insurance exchanges for which 2 million Americans have signed up. Now that the individual mandate is officially here, let me begin with an admission. Obamacare is awful. That's right. He said that. He said that, folks. Michael Moore. He goes on to say, that is the dirty little secret many liberals have avoided saying out loud for fear of aiding the president's enemies at a time when the ideal of universal health care needed all the support it could get. Unfortunately, this meant that instead of blaming companies like Novartis, which charges leukemia patients $90,000 annually for the drug Gleevec, or health insurance chief executives like Stephen Hemsley of United Health Group, who made nearly $102 million in 2009. That's a salary, folks. Salary. He did a job. Yeah, I bet it. I wonder if it was even 40 hours a week. Anyway, he made $102 million. How much is that per minute? Get a calculator, John.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's for the sky-high price of American health care. I mean, where did that money come from? From you and I paying health care premiums, folks. Okay. Anyway, the president's Democratic supporters bought into the myth that it was all those people going to get free colonoscopies and free chemotherapy for the fun of it. Okay? That's where the blame should go in, right? I don't think so, says Michael Moore. He says, I believe Obamacare's rocky start, clueless planning, a lousy website, insurance companies raising rates, and the president's telling people they could keep their coverage when in fact not all could, is a result of one fatal flaw. The Affordable Care Act is a pro-insurance industry plan implemented by a president who knew in his heart the single-payer Medicare for All model was the true way to go. When right-wing critics exposed the fact that President Obama endorsed a single-payer system before 2004, they're actually telling the truth. What we now call Obamacare was conceived at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, and birthed in Massachusetts by Mitt Romney, then the Republican governor. The president took RomneyCare, a program designed to keep the private insurance industry intact, and I want to add in profitable, very profitable, and just improve some of its provisions. In effect, the president was simply trying to put lipstick on the dog in the carrier on top of Mitt Romney's car. That was, of course, the story that was used against Romney so much about, I guess it's about forgetfulness, if not inhumanity, because it wasn't forgetfulness. They decided to take a little family trip from, where were they, Massachusetts, to Canada, I think, to drive up north. And they didn't have room in their station wagon for the whole family and all their bags and the family dog. So they strapped the dog to the carrier on the roof. Now, whether he was inside a dog cage, I don't know. But they put him outdoors with all the wind, you know, the car going 60 or 70 miles an hour, on the roof of their station wagon. Now, you know, that might not have been the cruelty that some of us could imagine.
No.
But it was kind of an analogy for his lack of compassion for living creatures. Oh. And I think, it, you know, that image did work to his disadvantage, along with quite a few others, during the campaign that he lost for president. Anyway, Michael Moore goes on. By 2017, he says, we'll be funneling Obamacare over $100 billion annually to private insurance companies. Funneling over $100 billion annually to private insurance companies. You can be sure they'll use some of that to try to privatize Medicare. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. Because if they do that, then they'll have all the money coming to them. See? Because right now, Medicare system goes, you pay to the government, who then figures out how much to pay the hospitals and the doctors. Anyway, so that'd be the next step, privatize it all. For many people, the affordable part of the Affordable Care Act risks being a cruel joke. The cheapest plan available to a 60-year-old couple making $65,000 a year in Hartford, Connecticut, so they're 60, they're not able to get into Medicare yet, will cost $11,800 in annual premiums. So almost wow. $1,000 a month for the 60-year-old couple making $65,000 a year, not rich, not in the 1%, in Hartford, Connecticut. And their deductible will be $12,600. So guess what? They can't even get any insurance until they've already paid out another $12,600 in 1 year. If both become seriously ill, they might have to pay almost $25,000 because it's a deductible for each of them.
Wow.
In a single year.
Yeah.
Now, pre-Obamacare, if they could have bought insurance that was cheaper but much worse, potentially, with unlimited out-of-pocket costs. Again, much worse because women could be charged more than men. Affordable Care Act says that can't happen. It has to be the same rate for women and men. And pre-existing conditions. If you're trying to get insurance, but you just had a heart attack or were diagnosed with diabetes, whoa, either the insurance company will say, no, we're not going to insure you. You're too big a risk. I thought risk was what insurance was all about. They could deny you coverage at all. Now, they can still charge you higher rates, by the way, but they can't deny you coverage. They just can allow you to pay four or five times as much, whatever. Yeah, anyway, Michael Moore goes on from the New York Times from the 31st. And yet, Moore says, I would be remiss if I didn't say this. Obamacare is a godsend. My friend Donna Smith, who was forced to move into her daughter's spare room at age 52 because health problems bankrupt her and her husband, Larry, now has cancer again. As she undergoes treatment, at least she won't be in terror of losing coverage and becoming uninsurable. Under Obamacare, her premium has been cut in half, in fact, to $456 per month. Let's not take a victory lap yet, but build on what there is to get what we deserve. Universal, quality health care. Those who live in red states, and you know who you are, need the benefit of Medicaid expansion. It may have seemed like smart politics in the short term for Republican governors to grab the opportunity offered by the Supreme Court rulings that made Medicaid expansion optional for states. But it was long-term stupid. If those 20 states hold out, they will eventually lose an estimated total of $20 billion in federal funds per year, money that would be going to hospitals and treatment. In blue states, yes, Michigan is considered a blue state, even though we have a Republican governor, because we vote usually for a Democratic president.
We're usually a Democrat.
So we're a blue state, yeah. Let's lobby for a public option on the insurance exchange, a health plan run by the state government rather than a private insurer. In Massachusetts, State Senator James B. Eldridge is trying to pass a law that would set one up. Some counties in California are also trying it. Get that, folks, counties in California. Of course, some counties in California are bigger than some states. of the United States in terms of population. Montana came up with another creative solution. Governor Brian Schweitzer, a Democrat who just completed two terms, set up several health clinics to treat state workers with no copays and no deductibles. The doctors there are salary employees of the state of Montana. Their only goal is their patient's health. If this sounds too much like big government to you, you might like to know that Google, Cisco, and Pepsi do exactly the same for their workers. In-house, no payment, health care. All eyes are on Vermont's plan. I was going to mention Vermont too, but Michael does here, for a single-payer system starting in 2017. If it flies, it will change everything, with many states sure to follow suit by setting up their own versions. That's why corporate money will soon flood into Vermont to crush it. The legislators who will go to the mat for this will need all the support they can get. If you live east of Mississippi, look up the bus schedule to Montpelier, which is their capital city, Vermont. So let's get started. Obamacare can't be fixed by its namesake. It's up to us to make it happen. Okay. By the way, his 2007 film Sicko is still very current. It did examine the American healthcare industry. I highly recommend all of Michael Moore's movies to you. But Sicko talks about the healthcare industry. A little congratulations. Michael's first film that he ever did, which was Roger and Me.
Yes, sir.
It was back in early 90s somewhere, I believe. It was all about the closing of General Motors plants in Flint, Michigan. And General Motors not caring at all. Yeah, no health care, no job retraining, just kick them out. And the city was in despair, and it's still, I think, in chaos up there. There's still a few people around, and I'm not sure why. It's true, General Motors did announce an initiative to build a new plant there sometime soon. But I bet it won't be the same kind of workers, because these days new plants mean high efficiency. They mean everything is computer automated, robotic stuff, and means they'll probably be only hiring college grads with that kind of background and training, unfortunately. It won't solve the problem of Flint, which is often referred to as a dead city, even though people are still living there and trying to make a go of life. And there's still, you know, small business and educational institutions and so on. But Michael Moore's Roger and Me has now been voted into the Library of Congress archives. And there's only a couple hundred films, maybe 600 now total, that over the years have been given this special archival status to be restored, preserved, and remain a bulwark of American society and what we're all about. My personal recommendation would be Fahrenheit 9/11, and Sicko is just one of those films to see with your friends, and let's get the problem solved. And it is true what many Democrats say: Obamacare is mostly thanks to Republicans. Okay, it's a Republican plan, and Republicans voted for it. Democrats wouldn't have wanted it, okay? But Obama, he sort of gave up, the right thing to do is just too hard to get. Republicans won't want to go for universal single payer, even though all the countries of the world that have it find that they have better health care than we do and at a lower cost, and everybody's covered, and it's simple. But no, Republicans wouldn't go for it. So we'll go for Obamacare, which gives no cost containment on either drugs or healthcare costs. And of course, all the insurance companies and the big health organizations, they love it. Oh, they had to reorganize and, you know, different paperwork for them, but they love it. They're going to make more money in the long run. And even with no limits on how much they can charge even. So Obamacare is very flawed. But the few reforms, we should be glad we have them. But now we've got to keep moving. So there, it's 2014. There's a direction to go, folks. Roger Moore, Michigan filmmaker. And if you ever get to Traverse City, go to his theater, the State Theater in Traverse City. It's great. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. I've been there every time in Traverse City. And for seniors, movies are 25 cents.
Can't beat that price. Yeah.
And many Saturdays they have popcorn for free for the kids for the matinees. So and they do a lot of they open the theater for community events for free, and it's just a wonderful nonprofit organization. I actually, that's one of those things that I I give money to, one of the nonprofits I give to with my few teacher retirement dollars, another great institution like WHFR, to give your donation dollars to in 2014. Meeting coming up of Citizens for Peace, as long as we're talking about wonderful things in the world. How do you bring about peace in your own life? How do you even start thinking about it? Citizens for Peace is starting a series, I believe, this month, even, in their monthly meetings.
Yes, this is Citizens for Peace. This group offers a series on power of nonviolence. The Reverend Rich Peacock will be the guest speaker at the next meeting for Citizens of Peace, 7 p.m. Tuesday, January 14th, 2014, at the Unity of Livonia in 28665 Mile in Livonia. He'll recommend ways to overcome racism, materialism, and militarism. This organization offers a workshop in building peaceful relationships, 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. Saturday, January 11th, 2014, at a private home in Livonia. Cost is $45 and includes a vegetarian lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Call Rosemary Doyle at 248-476-0791 for more information.
Yeah, you can Google their website, Citizens for Peace, or search if you don't like Google. Use a search engine and just on top of your Safari browser or whatever, or Bing it, Citizens for Peace, and you'll see that they have a schedule. Their regular monthly meeting is going to be Tuesday, January 14th at Unity of Livonia. And there's no cost to attend their regular monthly meeting. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, John.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, we'll do that if we have time. John was just showing me, and it's true. For the, you say, well, religious holidays are all over now. No, it's still part of the 12 days of Christmas. In fact, in some churches, and we may mention this specifically, January 6th is the biggest deal, a bigger deal than December 25th. Okay, so why is that, you ask? Okay, hang on, we'll get there sometime before 2 o'clock. Ralph Nader, one of my heroes in the world, for all of his, not only just presidential campaigns, but all of his crusading for issues of value to the average person. Whether it's car safety or civil rights or health care. Yeah, he's for universal single-payer health care, too. Yeah, he started an organization, a spinoff. He started the group Public Citizen also, which he has turned over to other people. But Public Citizen is a great organization, a nonprofit also, especially on health care issues. And they've taken on universal health care now as their number one issue, too, along with a few others. Anyway, he has written a comment in Common Dreams. That's commondreams.org. If you haven't checked out that website, what a great collection of opinions and ideas from the best thinkers in the United States. Okay. And around the world sometimes, too. But his comment from January 1st, 10 books to provoke conversation in the new year. And, you know, you can check it out. You can go, he's got a website, ralphnader.org or .com or something, so you can find it there, or go to commondreams.org. I'll just go down the list quickly. One book is by David Bollier, B-O-L-L-I-E-R, Think Like a Commoner, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons. And he points out that public lands, public airwaves, like we're a nonprofit, so we're a public station, online information, local civic assets, these are the commons areas, parks, you could think, okay, didn't I say that? And I didn't say that before. But he said, if you think about that, what if we expanded that? Okay, what if we expanded that? And that he thinks another world is possible. It's a whole book, folks. He says, we can build it ourselves now. We can make this happen. Think like a commoner. It's book number one. Number two, All the President's Bankers. Ooh, about the hidden alliances between big bankers and government leaders they've controlled for the past 100 years. All the President's Bankers. Number three, how can you represent those people? This is the whole question about criminal defense attorneys when they defend horrible people. Okay, and so he says, you'll learn a lot about our legal system. And the necessity for, of course, that representation. Number four, The Truth in Small Doses, Why We're Losing the War on Cancer and How to Win It. Remember the war on cancer? It was a big deal under Richard Nixon, who we mentioned in passing earlier in the hour. We're going to have a war on cancer. We're going to call it that, and we're going to, yeah. Didn't we have a war on drugs, too? And neither of those has been conclusive. Okay, a lot of money, never found a cure. Okay.
Well, still fighting the good battle, though.
Yeah, but why are we losing the war on cancer, but how can we win it? The Truth in Small Doses is the book by Clifton Leaf. The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives by Sasha Abramski. The Firm, the Story of McKinsey and Its Influence on American Business by Duff McDonald. Number 7, and this is one of my favorites. I always get a copy of this eventually. Censored 2014, Fearless Speech in Fateful Times. This is an annual collection of news articles that were not allowed to be published or only had limited publication, even though they're true and they're groundbreaking, earth-shattering, but they were censored by the people that own newspapers and television. The book in the series is called Censored, and you pick the year, and this the new edition is called Censored 2014. Lethal but Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. Are corporations people? No, they're not, Mitt Romney. They are not. And I don't, Supreme Court, you're wrong too, my humble opinion. Book number 9, Front Porch Politics, The Forgotten Heyday of American Activism in the 70s and 80s. Hey, I was there. That was the heyday. Oh, that's too bad. Oh, well. I did what I could. Number 10, and I got this book on order from Amazon because it sounds so good, The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System, written by Jerry Mander. Capitalist Papers is a fundamental critique of the intrinsic problems of the capitalist system that the author believes are inherent to its structure and unreformable. Mander is a former celebrated advertising executive. He goes deeper into the perverse incentives of corporate capitalism that almost anyone writing today, more than anybody else writing today, and man can he write, says Ralph Nader. Too bad that top Wall Streeters won't debate him. Jerry used a book that I used back in the late 70s, early 80s, entitled Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. And it's a big book, long book, scientific evidence that television is a drug. Watching television is a drug. It's an addiction, and it's not good for you. Of course, every drug introduced legally into the United States, whether it was called that or not, has never been able to be gotten rid of. And everybody loves their TV so much. What else would you do when you go home at night? I mean, but turn on your TV. Well, you turn on your radio and listen to WHFR. That would be radical. And of course, some people are listening now or listening online. So you can be radical and save your brain. You know, when I was unfortunately a few times in the hospital in the last few months, too many days to think about. As soon as they check in, oh, here's the remote for the TV, and it's free, or it's just a small fee. Call this number. I say no, thank you. No, it'll rot my brain and stunt my growth. And I'm not sure about the growth stunting. I'm shrinking at my age anyway. Seriously, folks. And they said, well, how can you say that? I said, I teach it.
Yes.
I teach. I know how bad it is as an activity that we do mindlessly. Okay. We turn off our mind, and that's never good. I mean, really. So, Jerry Mander's new book, The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System, doesn't sound like he thinks it might be unreformable. It doesn't sound like he's offering an alternative, but I'm sure there's some things we can do. So Ralph Nader says, man, can he write? Ralph Nader doesn't usually get that colloquial. Man, can he write?
Can he write?
Of course, so Gerrymander's Capitalism Papers. And he says at the end here, and sort of for 2014, our first show, Ralph says, summing up, years ago, books mattered more in provoking change. It is up to readers today not to be overwhelmed by information overload, to be selective and make books matter again. Ralph Nader, folks. In fact, I'm just finishing a book that Joanne Kruczynska let me borrow, called The Joy of Living, Unlocking the Secret and Science of Happiness, from a Buddhist teacher Yongyi, Mingyur, Rinpoche. And it's been great. It's been a great experience. I like to read all kinds of philosophy, and not very good at meditating, but I remember doing a lot of what I thought was meditating in the hospital when I was all alone in my, room, and they sort of forgot about me at times. I won't mention the hospital today. Okay, what else is happening here? Let's do the 12 Days of Christmas. What the heck? We promised, and there's at least 1 minute ahead of our show. John, what's it primarily about?
The 12 Days of Christmas is the festive Christian season beginning on Christmas Day, 25th of December, that celebrates the birth of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. This period is also known as Christmastide. This is different from the octave of Christmas, which is the liturgical time from Christmas Day until the Solemnity of Mary on 1st of January. The 12th day of Christmas falls on January 5th, but the 12th night can either precede or follow the 12th day, depending on which tradition is followed. The 12th day of Christmas is followed by the Feast of the Epiphany on January 6th. In some traditions, the Feast of Epiphany and 12th night overlap. The 12 days of Christmas are immediately followed by the Feast of the Epiphany, which celebrates the visit of the wise men, Magi, and their bringing of gifts to the child Jesus.
Mm-hmm. And further down, let me jump, because I know where it is in the next page over. What is that that church that sees the January 6th as bigger the Nativity? Okay. Eastern Christianity.
Ah.
Yeah, if Ned Apigian was here, he's our Dearborn Heights councilman on the staff, he would remind us that the Eastern Orthodox, also Oriental Orthodox and Eastern Catholic churches, the great feast of Epiphany, on 6 January, January 6th, is considered a higher ranked feast than the Nativity and commemorates the baptism of Jesus rather than the arrival of the Magi. So the Magi came, I guess, December 25th, but when Jesus was baptized, that's the big deal. Okay, and they observe these 12 days as a fast-free period of celebration. Whoa, so they get 12 days of stuffing their face, I guess, parties. And that's the Armenian Apostolic Church and the Armenian Catholic Church, however, which I believe Ned is most familiar with. They observe the Nativity of Christ on 6 January and thus do not have a 12-day period to celebrate. Oh, poor for them. In other words, they actually think that they celebrate the birth, so it is a big deal for the Armenian Church, mm-hmm. but they see the birth date as January 6th. So maybe he was baptized the same day, didn't wait 12 days to baptize him, I guess. I don't know how that worked out. But anyway, there you go. And I hope we explained all that to your liking. So you could keep partying through January 6th. Some people keep their Christmas tree lights up for that reason, the Epiphany, which is, of course, in the Western tradition, too. We have, and this is from Wikipedia, because they know everything, even though it's not all completely legitimate. So,
certainly we have many boar's head festivals that celebrate